Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. On today's program, we go behind the headlines with St. Louis Public Radio reporters to discuss a number of issues. We'll focus on a Ferguson city official who has decided to take off the second of two hats she wore. We'll take a closer look at some of the forthcoming entertainment options for St. Louis, but we'll begin discussing the proposed purchase of Monsanto by the German firm Bayer. What does it mean for St. Louis, if, and it's a big if it is ever consummated? Joining me in studio is business reporter Wayne Pratt. Wayne, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Well, this is pretty much in limbo right now. Seemed like a flurry of activity up until this week, and things stopped. What's going on?
Well, early this week was really when the flurry of activity hit the peak, I guess. Bayer came out detailing the proposal. $62 billion it put on the table for Monsanto. Monsanto said, you know, that's just not enough money. So now they'll probably go behind closed doors and see if they can come to agreeable terms.
It's hard to believe that $62 billion is not enough money.
Doesn't that boggle the mind when you think about it?
It surely does.
$122 a share, and they said no.
Yeah. Why is this a mutually advantageous deal? I mean, it would have to be if it's ever to be consummated. It's something good for both sides.
Yeah. The buyout for Monsanto, they would get a lot of money in the deal, a cash injection, which, let's face it, whenever these proposals come to fruition, that's usually what it's all about. One company wants to make a profit. They both do, but one will stand to make more money than the other out of the whole thing. But also, it's a trend in the agricultural industry. A lot of companies want to get bigger, and the easiest way to do that is to either go out and buy a company, like Monsanto tried to do with Syngenta last year, or be bought by another company. It expands the footprint. It gives them more option to increase profits, and it, as well, just makes them larger in the industry to squeeze out competition.
Well, when you take two big companies and make one big company out of them, there's a chance there's some antitrust elements here. Do any seem to be emerging at this stage?
Nothing really is emerging other than speculation at this stage. Bayer held a conference call this week with reporters around the world. They tried to downplay that aspect by stressing that these companies work in concert with each other instead of more overlap that you would expect because they are both so huge. And they are very familiar with one another because over the years, they have set up some joint initiatives. They have been customers and suppliers for each other. So they're stressing there may be some antitrust issues, but not as many as people would think off the top.
Well, the big question for us here in this neck of the woods, having just gone through the Anheuser-Busch acquisition by InBev, is what is this going to mean for us? Is it going to mean jobs lost? Is it going to mean tax revenue down? Is it going to mean contributions to charities and that sort of thing will go down?
Probably yes on all counts, but it's very early in the process, no, so we're not 100% sure. In that conference call, Bayer's CEO did point out that the deal that was put on the table, which was rejected, so this dollar figure may change, but he pointed to $1.5 billion in synergies. And as we know, synergies is kind of business speak, code word for reductions and cuts and so forth. So that could have an impact here in St. Louis. But they also said we're not going to divulge details of that because we're way too early in the process, so we can speculate all we want. But I would think that there would be some change here, definitely.
We've heard this song before, and of course, most recently with the Anheuser-Busch. But we lost about a third of our local employees in that transaction.
Yes, we did. And as I mentioned, we don't know how this may affect Monsanto. But what we do know is it'll still, at least at this point, remain a vital part of any combined company if this thing gets approved. The North American commercial operations will be based here. The seed and trait headquarters will come here. They'll also set up another operation in North Carolina. But that's really all we know on that front at this point. Anything else is pure speculation.
You know, there is an awful lot going on internationally in terms of acquisitions. It's all over the world, obviously. What is going on? Why now? Do you have any idea?
Well, there are a lot of international companies out there that have a lot of money, and they're looking to do something with it. And when they take a look around, how do we get bigger? What is a desirable market? They look at American brands and their link to the American consumer, which is still very valuable from an international perspective. So let's take something like Anheuser-Busch and Budweiser. As you mentioned, we've been through that. It's such a solid brand in such a desirable market and such a huge link with the consumer that it just makes it attractive. So you throw enough money on the table, eventually somebody in this country is going to say yes.
Is there any kind of a timetable that you have sensed or are aware of with regard to continuing these negotiations?
I knew you were going to ask me that, so I've been looking all morning, and I don't have an answer. They're going to go behind closed doors. There'll probably be some leaks coming out of the big business news services like a Reuters or Bloomberg over the next few weeks as each side tries to throw up a trial balloon or something to see what the public mood is from each aspect of a potential deal. But as of this point, there is really no timetable for this to close or come to any sense of completion, or if both sides just walk away. And if we compare it to the Syngenta saga of last year, that went on for months and months and months before we finally had a resolution.
And why did that fall through?
That fell through because the bottom line was money. Monsanto did not put enough on the table. They thought they did. Syngenta said no, and now it's being bought by a Chinese chemical company that did put enough money on the table.
China's becoming even more active than usual in all of this.
Yeah, and from what I can gather on that, it's because their companies do have a lot of money and they're looking to do something with it, and they want to expand a global reach and a global footprint. They're really attracted in the American consumer, but as has been shown with the Syngenta deal, which is based in Switzerland, they also have their eye on some other global areas as well.
Monsanto was involved in a court decision yesterday involving a lawsuit concerning damages from PCBs. It was a $42 million deal. Monsanto doesn't have to pay all of that, as I understand it. But is this likely to have any bearing at all on the negotiation with Bayer?
From what I can gather at this point, probably not. The company is so big, it's probably one of several legal actions out there that are pending or that it's going through. And Bayer would be aware of that at the point that they put that offer on the table and decided we want to continue negotiations. If it was going to impact anything, I think Bayer would have said, we're going to put the brakes on this right now and see how it all shakes out.
Is this deal going to go through?
My gut says yes. Huh. And that's because the tone of both companies. They seem to be cooperative and they seem to be pleasant with each other. Bayer's CEO and another senior official were in town last month to present the letter personally to Monsanto's CEO. And that's kind of rare. Usually this is done through some intermediaries or some other methods. But the fact that they've been here and they've talked and they've known each other for years, my gut says they're going to come to some sort of agreeable term.
What kind of a reputation does Bayer have?
Bayer has been around forever. It has a very good reputation in the business community. They have some solid practices. They have some solid products. And they also pointed out on the conference call this week that they've had a presence in the U.S. longer than Monsanto has. So that tells you to last that long and become that big, they're doing something right.
Any other part of this story that we need to be talking about?
Well, as you can expect, Monsanto's name could change if this becomes a done deal, which I think everybody could assess that that was probably an element. As we know, there's some negative connotation with a sector of the global population when it comes to Monsanto. I'll let people out there debate the reasons behind that to their own liking. But I think that's interesting that the Monsanto name, although it's been around forever, I think the original Monsanto company was founded here in St. Louis. I believe it was 1901. Mm-hmm. So it could go away after all that time. That's another interesting aspect, especially for us here in St. Louis.
I wonder if name change becomes part of the negotiations.
I would think so. I would think so. How can it not, I guess, if Bayer wants its own way and they're putting all that money on the table?
Yeah. I'm going to take a very quick call here. It's from Bill, and he wants to ask a question concerning layoffs. People are worried about this, having gone through it just recently. Bill, quick question, please.
Sure. Far be it for me to interject a political idea in any discussion, but 20 years ago, when the snail darters were going to be protected in California, that was going to put a lot of loggers out of business, I said to myself, God loves the snail darters, but he loves loggers too. And if you're not willing to give the loggers fair compensation, the snail darters cannot let the door hit them in the butt on their way out. And that principle should apply to mergers and acquisitions as well as trade deals and automation. Somebody from the government needs to pass some legislation, that have to be federal, saying if you're going to merge or acquire and people are going to be laid off as a part of that, if you can't give them a fair severance, and we can quibble about what that should be, 5% per year of service or whatever for a period of time, then the merger or acquisition or automation or trade deal should be prohibited. If the deal isn't going to save you enough money to give your laid off people enough money to be whole, then it's not worth doing.
All right.
And Bill, I think that's long overdue for discussion at the federal level.
Bill, thank you for the call. Neither one of us has a federal position. I'm not sure we're in a position to do it other than either agree or disagree with
it. Well, I think he hit the core of the argument there, and that is quibbling over what you think is fair for any severance package, and that could be debatable among both companies, especially of this size that we're talking about today.
Okay. Well, we will be watching for the next step in this process and see how much more than $62 billion is necessary to make
still,
this thing
still
happen.
Still boggles my mind. It really does.
It does. Thank you so much, Wayne Pratt. Ferguson City Attorney Stephanie Carr has resigned 2 months after she quit as the town's prosecuting attorney, but she still has plenty of municipal work, as it turns out. Longtime journalist and attorney Bill Frivol is joining us now by phone. Bill, thank you for being with us.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, good. I understand you're doing a little babysitting on the other side of the country, but all the more reason to thank you for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Are you surprised that Ms. Carr hung on for so long?
Yes, I'm surprised she hung on for so long, and she's come to represent a lot of what was wrong with Ferguson and other municipal courts. Her office was involved in abusing that failure to comply charge that the police used so much, that they used both before the Brown shooting back in 2014, and that they also used quite a bit to arrest protesters during the protests after Brown. The Justice Department report back about a year ago or a little more than a year ago cited that abuse, the department's abuse of the failure to comply charge, to being an example of their unconstitutional police practices. 94% of the people charged with failure to comply were African Americans, for example. But then I think really made things even more difficult was the way she then pressed the prosecutions this year of folks who had been arrested near the demonstrations. And they lost about five different failure to comply cases when they just simply didn't have the evidence. And the thought that they would push forward on those prosecutions, costing the city a lot more money as they did that, when the prosecutions were so flawed, is a little hard to comprehend.
Yeah, she's been criticized a bit for prosecuting cases that have been called both unwinnable and unconstitutional.
Right.
What's unconstitutional in this particular sense? Does anything come to mind?
Here's the way the Ferguson police used to use the failure to comply charge. And I'm taking this from the Justice Department report. So let's say they stopped a motorist, they would then ask not just the motorist to show his driver's license or her driver's license, but also everyone in the car. And if someone in the car said, hey, you don't have any right to see my identification, they would be arrested for failure to comply. Well, it's gotta be at least failure to comply with a lawful order. That's not a lawful order to force passengers in a car to identify themselves. I mean, they used failure to comply. Two sisters sitting in a car by their house, backing their car into the driveway. They were cited for failure to comply. It was just abused a great deal, and it was also used as a way to raise money for the city of Ferguson.
Well,
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, and then, more recently, there definitely would be a way in which you could arrest demonstrators who were told, face-to-face that they were engaged in an unlawful assembly where, say, rocks or bottles or water bottles are being thrown. That would be a constitutional arrest. But in a lot of these cases that were dismissed in the last few weeks where the prosecutor tried to win them and lost them to second-year law students from SLU and Arch City Defenders. In a lot of those cases, they just didn't have the evidence that the person arrested had ever been ordered to disperse. One of the persons was, I think, Michael Powers, and who worked for the the president of the Board of Aldermen, and you know, he just said that he had been trying to comply with the police orders to disperse, but he was barricaded in by armored vehicles. He asked the police officer how he should leave the area. Instead of offering a way to get out, he arrested him. I mean, that kind of arbitrary, you know, behavior is just clearly unconstitutional.
Well, she was singled out for criticism in the consent decree with the Justice Department, and managed to hang on for, you know, a year or so, whatever that time frame was. Is there no process whereby someone who has been so cited can be removed from office?
Well, I mean, someone could file, I suppose, could file a bar complaint against her. I'm not, and it's not clear to me right on top of my head what the grounds would be. I mean, prosecutors have a lot of, they've got something that's in the law called absolute immunity. It's to protect them from, you know, unhappy defendants suing them all the time. So you can't be sued. A prosecuting attorney can only under the most extraordinary kinds of, or can hardly ever be sued in court. But, you know, that somebody could file, I guess, some sort of a bar complaint against her. As you say, the Justice Department report of March of 2015, another thing that they cited her for was giving favorable treatment to the judge of the Ferguson court and to a relative of a Ferguson police officer, and getting cases against them dismissed in other municipalities. So sort of, you know, playing favorites in the way the municipal court operated, while meanwhile running the, you know, being involved in the unconstitutional way in which the Ferguson municipal court itself operated.
Have you ever heard of a situation in which a city attorney was also acting as the city's prosecutor?
You know, I couldn't tell you right off the top of my head. I don't think that it's unheard of. And what I think is actually fairly common, although I haven't studied this, is for a single law firm to be providing both the city attorney and the prosecuting attorney for a municipality. I mean, you know, that's what was going on here. Not only was she a prosecutor, but then other lawyers from her firm, which is Curtis Hines, Garrett, and O'Keefe, were also serving as prosecutors. And, you know, the Post-Dispatch has reported that the billings that they charged this year for some of these, you know, some of these very weak cases that they didn't win, was in the neighborhood of $40,000. Last year, $60,000 for that firm. The year before, $30,000. So, you know, at a time when Ferguson's got all sorts of financial problems, and when people are complaining about the cost of complying with the constitutional requirements, well, what about the cost of not complying with the constitutional requirements?
Yeah, I have in my notes here that this particular firm has attorneys hold key positions in 20 municipalities in this area. And listen to this. She still has plenty of work to do. The firm lists Carr as city attorney in Calverton Park, Edmondson, Belrive Acres, special counsel in Brentwood, and city prosecutor in Hazelwood and Belnor. This woman's busy.
Yes. Yes, she is. And it was her prosecuting attorney. She also worked as you point out, prosecuting attorney in Hazelwood, and that's where Ronald Brockmeyer, the municipal court judge in Ferguson, had a red light camera ticket dismissed as a result of her behavior. So, you know, having all those different hats and all those various municipalities can sometimes be result in this kind of unfortunate corruption of the court.
In all the discussion about municipal court reform here and its various incarnations over the last almost 2 years, has there been any real attempt to address this part of the court process?
Well, you know, there has been. And there were provisions. I'm having a little trouble recalling off the top of my head whether it was in Senate Bill 5 or whether it was in a Supreme Court order that tried to eliminate some of the conflicts of interest involved in these Muni court situations. But, you know, I think what we really, what's really needed is a much bigger solution. I could certainly see the municipal courts all being combined into those three St. Louis County municipal courts that exist now for the unincorporated areas. I really don't see the reason for continuing all of these small little municipal courts with all the conflicts of interest and questionable activities involved.
Well, there's plenty of that going on, needless to say. Bill Freivogel, thanks for taking time out of your time off to be with us. Nice to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
That's Bill Freivogel, attorney and journalist. We'll take a break and come back with a look at some pretty big entertainment news for our area. Willis Reiner Arnold will join us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now to cultural reporter Willis Reiner Arnold. Forest Park is going to be live with the Sound of Music a little later this year, Willis. The Lou Fest has been scheduled, and boy, a lot of people are really looking forward to the schedule.
It's true. They kind of stepped up and, I think, put out a pretty good lineup this year. Every year the lineup's debated how good it is, whether it stands up with other national festivals, but I think it's pretty interesting this year.
What makes this particular event as popular? 50,000 people last year. That's a lot of people.
Right, and that was up from 36,000 the year before. I think it's just a growing event. People are really proud that people are able to get this type of music, these headliners. This year they've stepped up and are kind of bringing in a lot of local acts as well, and I think it's just kind of that synergy between national headliners and local music.
And the location of the fest is terrific.
Yes, absolutely.
Forest Park.
Yeah, I spoke with one local musician, and they were just saying that it was the best kind of place that you could expect to play in the city.
Let's talk about some of those acts that you have mentioned. What comes to mind? What are you particularly excited about?
I'm particularly excited about two acts. One is Lauryn Hill. I think will be a very interesting performer to see specifically in this location. I also really like Bruiser Queen is a local punk act that I think will do a really good job.
We can listen to a little of their music and get some sense of what's ahead in September. Which one do you want to play first, Lauryn Hill?
I think we should go with that.
All right, let's try it.
Yo, remember back on The Bully when cats used to harmonize like...
Yo.
Yo. Yo. My men and my women, don't forget about the dame. This is not the most the king. Yo. It's about a thing. Yo.
Feel
yo.
Real good,
wave your hands in the air and lick two shots in the atmosphere.
We're looking for your friend, the one you let hit it and never called you again. Remember when he told you he was about to Benjamins? You act like you ain't him, they give him a little trim to begin. Now you think you really gonna pretend like you wasn't down and you called him again. Plus when you give it up so easy, you ain't even fooling him. If you did it then, then you probably can.
All right. Well, that's an indication of a number of things that can be pointed out with regard to the Lou Fest. A lot of diversity in the music this time.
I think that they really did make a concerted effort to hear people's earlier criticisms that it was not diverse enough or representative of the various communities in St. Louis. So they're bringing in more hip-hop. It seems like they're bringing in more soul music as well. They're bringing in some country music as well as those other acts. Chris Stapleton is a headliner this year, and he's a pretty quality country musician.
And the Preservation Band from New Orleans is also going to be there.
Absolutely. That would be another favorite that I forgot to mention.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
Looking forward to that. Well, let's take a listen to another one of the, all of these performances are at night, or are they daytime performances as well?
Daytime and evening. They kind of begin early in the afternoon and go until a reasonable late hour in the evening. Chris Stapleton, I mentioned earlier, is a country musician, and he's got a song called Nobody to Blame that he'll probably play as well.
You want to hear any of that, or do you want to go right to Bruiser Queen?
I think we should go with the Stapleton first, actually.
Okay.
She took down a photograph of our wedding day. Ripped it down the middle and threw my half away. And I got nobody to blame but me. I got nobody to blame but me. She broke all my fishing rods, put my guns in hot, threw my clothes out in the yard and changed out all the locks. And I got nobody to blame but me. I got nobody to blame but me.
Well, the Willis Ryder Arnold, the first two selections we played here really do indicate that there are a lot of different kinds of voices going to be on the stage.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, let's listen to one more from the Lou Fest. And Bruiser Queen is something that I think some of our staff had wanted to hear. We'll give a listen to what that sounds like and see what's going to happen. That's Bruiser Queen, a local band, by the way.
Yes.
In total, how many different acts are there going to be, Willis?
I'm not sure exactly. I think locally they'll have about six acts at Lou Fest, six local acts, and a much broader number for the total acts.
And of course, the Lou Fest isn't the only event coming up a little bit later in the year. There's something new.
No, in September there will also be Murmuration Festival, which focuses on technology, innovation, science, and the arts. And they also have a musical headline, headliners that are pretty interesting.
What does that actually mean, focusing on technology?
Well, they're kind of trying to highlight the fact that St. Louis is a really innovative community, that there's a lot of people that are considering kind of how they can use technology in their art and in their businesses. So there will be some like makers showcases and some bands that will perform that will have technology as part of what they do.
And the venue?
The venue will be actually at Cortex. They've partnered. Oh. Brian Cohen, who founded Lou Fest, is doing this now with Cortex.
Well, that's the proper place for this, for the memory. There's no question about that. Let's have a quick listen to, I think it's called Super Duper Rescue Heads?
Yes, by the band Deer Huff.
That does have sort of a high-tech feel, almost robotic in a sense.
Absolutely.
What about tickets to these events, Willis?
I think you can find them both online at their websites, at the Lou Fest website and at the Murmuration website. And they're both on sale, I think, at the moment. Murmurations may not be, but would be going up soon.
Well, lots to look forward to and plenty of excitement in the entertainment field. Willis Ryder Arnold, thank you so much for being with us, bringing us up to speed on Lou Fest Murmuration. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.